Imagine if the name your parents called you as you were growing up was dog. My friend Lee, who grew up in the mountains of southwest China, as he was a young boy, his parents always called him little brother dog. And they called him that because they were afraid if they called him by a boy's name or a child's name, the evil spirits would know he was a child and would carry him away or would harm him. If you were to walk into his house in the village, above their door, you would see a mirror. And that mirror was there so that if any evil spirit tried to enter the house, they would see their reflection in the mirror and be scared away. If Lee or any of his brothers or sisters were sick or some other bad situation happened in their family, their only recourse was to go to the village witch doctor and to pay a fine. And then the village witch doctor would tell them what animal they needed to sacrifice in order to deal with the situation. When Lee became adult, one day two men walked into his village and they befriended him and began to share the gospel with him. And they told him of a great God, the Most High God, who is more powerful than evil spirits that he had feared and appeased his whole life. And he put his faith in that God. And as a result of his faith in God, the gospel began to change him, began to transform him, and he began to go and do good works. He shared the gospel with his wife and the rest of his family. He shared with others in his village. He would travel to distant villages farther away and share with them. One day, two of the men that he had led to faith were in another village, and they were there doing construction work. And while they were working, they would share the gospel, and some people believed, and they began to gather them into a group to study the word together. And one evening, as they were meeting in that group, the police showed up, and they arrested these two brothers, put them in jail. I guess it's true, you get a phone call everywhere, so they called Brother Lee and told him that if they did not pay a fine, which they did not have, they couldn't get out of jail. So he gathered together the money and went and paid their fine. And the police were smart enough to realize if this guy's the one that shows up with the money, he's probably the ringleader. So they let the two brothers out of jail and put him in their place. They transferred him to the county seat town because the officials had been noticing that the gospel was beginning to spread through these villages, and they were very concerned. And so they began to do everything they could to try to convince Lee to turn back from the gospel. They said, if you keep believing, we're going to keep finding you. And if you keep sharing the gospel, we're going to keep arresting you. And when that tactic didn't work, they said, if you'll turn back from following Christ, we'll make you the village leader. We'll make you the village chief, a position of authority and respect and even monetary gain. And in all these things, Lee said no. Shortly thereafter, he and I got together and we had planned to visit. I had no idea this had been going on in his life. And as he began to share this, I was just in shock. And then I asked him, I said, how was it that in the midst of what was going on, you were able to say no? I will keep following Jesus no matter what you threaten to do or what you offer me. And he said, because when I heard the gospel, I knew it was true. I knew it was true. And he said, I remember the day I was baptized. And the two brothers that baptized me asked me several questions similar to what you might hear us asking someone being baptized at our church. But the last question they asked me was, even if they persecute you or hit you or curse you or mock you or throw you in jail or threaten to kill you, will you still follow Jesus and never turn back? And he said, when I answered that question, I said yes, and my decision was made. Brother Lee's belief in the gospel resulted in good fruit in his life. When we began our study of Titus, we asked the question, what does a healthy church look like? we saw that the church has been entrusted with the gospel, and that as the gospel begins to change us, we grow in godliness, and unless we grow in godliness, we will not become a more healthy church. Next, we looked at the ministry of elders in the church, and we saw that without healthy leaders, you cannot have a healthy church. We also saw that a church is made up of all generations, and that all of us need to live lives worthy of imitation, and those older in the faith need to be training those younger. Last week, Carrie reminded us of the importance that each of us are teachers, and that even if the only person we have to teach is ourselves. This week, as we finish our study of Titus, we want to continue to think about what is a healthy church. We're going to return to the gospel that we started with. And we want to answer two questions this morning. First, what is the gospel? And secondly, what is the fruit of living out that gospel? How does the gospel impact us? So our first question, what is the gospel? We're going to see the answer to that in verses 4 through 7 of Titus chapter 3. And as you look at this passage, you're going to see that 4 through 7 are one long sentence. Most of your translations will read that way. But the main subject and verb of this sentence is God saved, or He saved. He saved us. As we look more closely at these verses, we're going to see three things. We're going to see when salvation came, how salvation didn't come, and how salvation did happen. Verse 4 tells us when salvation came. It says, but when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared. Now, God has always been good and kind. These are not new qualities for God because they're intrinsic in who He is. They're a part of who He is. But there was a definite moment in history when they appeared. That was Christmas Day, the birth of Jesus. When Jesus came into the world, the kindness and goodness of God was visible in bodily form. God's kindness became more than a rumor, more than a promise. It became physical. People could see it and touch it. Jesus, the God-man, came. He came to show us more clearly who God is. He also came to show us how great the goodness and loving kindness of God our Father is. Salvation came with Jesus. But how does salvation work? How are we saved? Verse 5 tells us first how we're not saved. Again, verse 5 says, He saved us. Not because of works done by us in righteousness. Not because of works done by us in righteousness. We're not saved by any good works we have done. Do you ever make an important decision by drawing up a list of pros and cons? Imagine if God were to use such a list to decide whether to save us. On the con side, everything we see in verse 3, we were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hatred of others, and hating one another. All of that on the con side. And then on the pro side, nothing. It's just blank. And then God takes and writes in big, bold letters across the paper, my goodness, my love, my kindness. God did not look at us and say, you know, on the balance, they're not so bad. There's some goodness there. He did not look at us and say, you know what? I can see some potential there. He saw everything that was written in verse 3. And so much more. There were 1,000 reasons for God to condemn us forever. Yet despite all this, God saved us. But why? Take a moment and ask yourself, why would God save me? Why would God accept me? Is it because of the good things I've done? Is it because of all my works of righteousness? No. We are saved by the grace of God through faith in His Son and the work He did for us on the cross. Saving faith, true faith, doesn't involve putting more faith in myself. It involves removing all the faith in myself and putting my faith in God. You may be asking the question, wait a minute, is this fair? We all know people that we would describe as good yet aren't believers. They do good things. They're kind towards others. They support charities for the poor. They're good neighbors. They've never been arrested for any serious crime. Maybe they've never even gotten a speeding ticket. In fact, they may be nicer than some of the Christians you know. Is it fair that they aren't saved? What follows in the second half of verse 5 and 6 and following will help us understand the answer to that. Why then does God save us? Look at verse 5. It says, He saved us according to His own mercy. We are saved by God's mercy. Think about mercy for a moment. You heard John, as he was introducing our service, talk about how grace and mercy seem to go together. Grace, in the biblical sense, is unmerited favor. God gave us His Son, even though we did nothing to earn it. Mercy is closely related. It has a slightly different meaning. If grace is God giving us what we don't deserve, mercy is God withholding what we do deserve. Because of our sin, what we deserve is punishment. However, what we get instead is salvation. Withholding the punishment that we deserve is mercy. God saves us by His mercy. He saves us from punishment and gives us salvation instead. Think back to that good person you had in mind a moment ago. You've seen their good works, but we also know that they are far from perfect. If you think they don't ever do anything unkind or wrong or selfish, just have an honest conversation with their spouse or their children or their roommate. We all have sinned. None of us are perfect. All of us, even those who appear good on the outside, are deserving of punishment. Compared to a holy and righteous God, all of our good acts are nothing more than filthy rags. So God is just to condemn even good people. Tim Chester, in his very helpful commentary, Titus for You, puts it this way. He says, verses 3 through 7 are a beautiful summary of the kindness of God to people who don't deserve it. God's kindness is seen in the sending of His Son and the sending of His Spirit so that we might share in the rebirth of all things. Paul has explained the gospel to us. He's shown us how salvation works and how it doesn't. In one sense, it'd be nice just to end right here and just spend time meditating on the goodness and kindness of God. But Paul's got more to say to us. He wants us to see how the gospel impacts our life. Paul is going to show us some of the fruit of the gospel. In order for a plant to have good fruit, what does it need? It needs good roots. And the gospel is the roots. If we want fruit, we can't cut off the roots. So we can't forget the gospel. So what's our second question or answer? What is the fruit of the gospel? How does the gospel impact our lives? I want us to look at three fruits of the gospel in these closing verses. The first one I want to talk about tells us what not to do. And then we're going to look at two things that we should do. Look at verse 8. It says, "This saying is trustworthy." What is Paul talking about there? He's going back to the gospel he's just explained. He's connecting the gospel with the instructions he's about to give. And then he says, "I want to insist on these things." So we need to pay close attention to them as well. We never want to disconnect how we should live as Christians from the gospel. If we do, Christianity just becomes moralism, a list of do's and don'ts with no reason or power to obey. So the first thing Paul is going to talk to us about is not stirring up division. Not stirring up division. Let's look at verses 9 through 11 first. Here we're told what not to avoid. It says, "But avoid foolish controversies, genealogies, dissensions, and quarrels about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless." You may have never had a contentious discussion about genealogies. I know I haven't, but that's not the point, is it? We are reminded to avoid divisiveness and instead focus on the gospel that brings us together. Yet, in our sinful nature, it's so easy for us to get drawn into whatever the latest controversy in the church is. Verse 9, Paul tells Titus to avoid them. Then in verse 10, he raises the stakes. He says to Titus, "Warn them." Why is Paul making such a big deal about this? It's a big deal because it destroys the unity of the church, and Paul is jealous for the church. Remember our study of Ephesians 4? Paul writes there that we should be eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. Let me quote Tim Chester again because I think he says it really well. He says, "Paul is passionate about unity in the church because this is God's eternal plan. This is why Christ died. And through our unity, we display God's wisdom. When viewed this way, suddenly we can see why there is a need to deal decisively with a divisive person who wants to promote disunity. This is what's at stake: the purposes of God, the work of the cross, the success of the mission." Look at the process Paul gives in dealing with someone who is contentious in verse 10. He says, "As for a person who stirs up division, after warning him once, then twice, have nothing more to do with him." It sounds familiar, doesn't it? It's basically the same instructions that Jesus gave in Matthew 18. A first warning, then a second, more public warning, and then excommunication or treating them as a non-believer. This is a process we commonly refer to as church discipline. Paul goes on to say in verse 11 that a person who stirs up division is warped and sinful and self-condemned. Paul's using very strong language here, and so we need to pay careful attention to it. Let me say that with church discipline, the kind of things that often come to mind are things that are maybe repetitive in nature, like being in an unrepentant extramarital affair, or something we saw earlier in the book of Titus, someone who is preaching a false gospel. But Paul is so rightly jealous for unity in the church that he is saying that to stir up division in the church should also fall under church discipline. A few months ago, in the middle of the night, we were awakened by the sounds of our smoke alarm going off. And once the fog kind of cleared, was able to get up and figure out what was going on, there was a leak coming through our ceiling from the attic. Drip, drip, drip. And that water reminds me I need to drink. But the water was going through the smoke alarm and causing it to go off. And imagine what it would be like if I just decided, you know what, it's just a small drip, just a few drops, one every 2 or 3 seconds. Let's just leave it alone. But even just in the 2 or 3 hours that the water had been dripping like that, the water had gotten into 3 rooms in the house. Ceilings and walls had to be repainted. The damage was not small. Yeah, it was a small amount of water, but the damage was not small, and it had to be dealt with. It's the same with someone stirring up division in the church. It might seem like a small thing, but the consequences can be huge if it's not dealt with. So we need to be careful here, though, that we don't assume the purpose of church discipline is to remove someone from the church. That is not the purpose. The purpose of church discipline is always redemptive, to restore them. Our goal with church discipline is to restore a person to a right relationship with God and the church. So whenever we practice it, of course, we want to be prayerful and patient, giving God time to work in their heart. If you find yourself bumping up against someone like that, be the person that helps stop it. When you encounter someone stirring up division or grumbling or gossiping, I encourage you, be a cul-de-sac, not a thoroughfare. Don't be the person that it passes through on to other people. Be the person that helps stop it. If someone has a complaint against someone else in the church, encourage them to go talk to the person concerned. So, having dealt with the negative, not stirring up division, let's look at 2 positive fruits of the gospel. The next one, devoting ourselves to good works. Look back at verse 8. Paul writes, I want you to insist on these things so that those who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. Paul's already told us that good works don't save us, but he is saying, as a result of the grace of God working in our life, we should do good works. This is not a new thought for Paul. Look back to verse 1 in chapter 3. Paul says, remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for what? Every good work. Look ahead to verse 14, chapter 3. Paul says, and let our people learn to devote themselves to good works so as to help cases of urgent need and not be unfruitful. We read about it last week as well in chapter 2. In verse 14, Paul writes, Jesus gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works. Paul is saying we need to be a people who are devoted for good works. We stress the gospel a lot because we want the gospel to change us. God is a good God, and he sends his people to do good works. And so we need to be a people who are proactively looking for opportunities to do good works through blessing and serving others in Jesus' name. Yesterday morning, our benevolent team was here giving out the bags of food that you donated and turkeys and rolls and pies to families in need in our community. I think over 50 families were served. Yesterday afternoon, there was a group of people that were going around raking leaves and doing some yard work for people who needed help. Last night, there was a group here stuffing stockings to give away through the Salvation Army to people in need. Thank you. Thank you for being a church that strives to do good works. In addition, as you heard from Carrie last week, another way that we are trying to do good works is through disaster relief. Hurricanes Florence and Michael were devastating to the people in North and South Carolina, Florida, and Georgia, and so we wanted to be a part of that. We sent a small team to Davis, North Carolina, to help there. And there was one home in particular that I will not get out of my mind quickly. In this house, the water had risen and gotten up into the floor a few inches deep. There was a tree that had fallen over onto the house and busted a big hole in the roof. There was all the water coming in from the bottom and down from the top. There was severe damage. And we began to carry their belongings out of their house and put them by the roadside to be hauled away to the dump. Furniture, appliances, household goods, bedding, clothing. And the pile of stuff by the road, it was more than just stuff to them, was much higher than what was left in the house. Our team was able to devote ourselves to good works. Not only did we help restore people's homes to a place they could begin to move back in again, we were also able to share the hope that we have because of Christ. In most cases, the conversations we had, the care that we expressed, meant much more to people than the physical help that we give. Paul is pushing us out of this church building into our neighborhoods, to the nations, to be a people that does good works. We don't know when the next opportunity will arise for us to do disaster relief, but I encourage you, please consider being a part of it. Third, the last thing we want to look at this morning, we are people changed by the gospel. We're a people that does shows the fruit of the gospel. And one of the other ways that happens is by sending our best, by sending our best. Look at verses 12 through 15. Paul writes, he says, "When I send Artemas and Tychicus to you, do your best to come to me at Nicopolis, for I've decided to spend the winter there. Do your best to speed Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way." One of the ways we devote ourselves to good works as a church is to send our best. Paul is telling Titus to send Zenas the lawyer and Apollos to him. I find this very interesting because we know from our study of this book that Crete, where Titus is working, was a place that the gospel had spread to relatively recently. It was not a place the gospel had been years and years, probably just months. Paul had just finished in chapter 1 telling Titus to appoint elders in every town. And yet he's telling Titus to send Apollos. We don't know much about Zenas, but Apollos is someone that's mentioned elsewhere in Scripture. Acts chapter 18 describes Apollos as competent in the Scriptures and one who is fervent in spirit and spoke and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus. In a place like Crete, Apollos would have been extremely helpful to Titus. Yet Paul instructs him to send him. Why? Why would Paul ask Titus to send his best when clearly there was more work that needed to be done there in Crete? Because God has sent his best. God sent the perfect Son of God to us to show us how to live and to redeem us from our sin. As we continue to become a church-planting church, we're going to have the opportunity to send people out from this body. Following the model given to us, we want to send our best. Our best young people, our best families. The gospel is not something we hold on to and hoard, but share with others. And in the same way, we want to share our resources, including our people, with others. So as a church, we want to send our best. You also see that as Paul instructs Titus here to send Zenas and Apollos to him, he says, "See that they lack nothing." Paul is asking the church to help support those being sent financially. In 2 weeks, we're going to begin our Advent season, where we celebrate the birth of Jesus sent from God the Father to us. It's also a season where we begin to take up our Lottie Moon Christmas offering so that international missionaries can be sent. Like Brother Lee, we want to see the fruit of the gospel evident in our lives. We want to be a people who promote unity in the church, who are devoted to good works, and who send their best. I want us to close this morning by watching a short video from our partners among the river people. As you watch it, I'm just going to give you a heads up. At one point, there's some pretty large, loud background noise going on. A tractor is driving by, and you can't see it, but you'll hear it. So don't be distracted by it. Just keep focused on what they're saying. But as you'll see, God is doing a great work there, and he's doing it despite persecution that's going on. So, and it started with people like Cameron and the Wilsons being sent. Let's watch this together.